used to think about immature things. You know, like, do you love me? Do you want me? Are you gonna call me like you said you would? Is this really your real phone number?
Get money. New money.
Rich boy, sell it quick. Folk niggas wanna check. Shit tight, no snack. Just bought a Cadillac.
Throw some D's on that bitch.
Just bought a Cadillac.
Throw some D's on that bitch.
Just bought a Cadillac. Rich boy, sell it quick. Folk niggas wanna check. Shit tight, no snack. Just bought a Cadillac.
Throw some D's on that bitch.
Just bought a Cadillac.
Throw some D's on that bitch.
Just bought a Cadillac. Boy, selling crack, folk niggas wanna check. Shit tight, no slick. Just bought a Cadillac, took it to the top. Top, got the damn top drop. Two color flip flop in the red lollipop.
This house in the parking lot.
But I still got my Glock cock. New money, motherfucker, don't you see the big dot? Don't you see the big tie? Don't you see the big rims? Wonder who they hating on lately, baby, this is him. Candy pint, gated skin seats, call me Dundee. Hope in your hood, I'm the one that you wanna be. Haters wish they could feel the wood in my 83. Ride with no tits, so the motherfucker knows me. Rich boy, sell it quick, folk niggas wanna check. Shit tight, no snack, just bought a Cadillac.
Throw some D's on that bitch.
Just bought a Cadillac.
Throw some D's on that bitch.
Just bought a Cadillac.
Recording, bro.
Keep talking, fool.
Recording.
The robot.
So you got 12 audiobooks recorded this week.
Yeah, and just in the past 2 weeks, I've got 12 now, trying to become prolific narrator.
Off real.
Like your third life.
My third life?
Yeah.
But yeah, I was doing a little bit of black voice today.
Black voice.
You give us a sample?
I mean, I pretty much just talk. Oh, lower it a little bit. Say foe instead of four.
Oh, that's deeper. A good one.
Yeah.
Grant doesn't really have a black scent.
Not really. It's kind of like I grew up in Chicago Midwest, and then on my white side, we'd go to Tennessee a lot, and that's why I speak so slow, you know, so, yeah.
Speaking of slow is good.
I've been told I sound Southern when I tell people where I'm from who don't know, and they're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense, your accent. I'm like, do I have an accent? I just talk real slow.
You do kind of have a Southern accent, you know. It's like a sprinkle if there's a seasoning of Kelby, you know.
It's like it's in the word accent. It's in the word accent because Grant just said accent, and Kelby said accent.
Yeah, you know, I didn't notice that. But, you know,
it's the I's and the E's. It's the same in Oklahoma. If I, you know, am around Okies too, because I took a. Like, where's your accent from? I took that New York Times quiz, and it's funny because I was born in Fairfax, Virginia, and it put my accent as Richmond, Virginia. So I don't actually have an Oklahoma accent, but like here is the same thing. People will say like pillow instead of pillow and pin instead of pen. So it's just like they just mix the I's and the E's up.
It's
like a South thing.
It's the way you said Virginia, too.
Yeah.
Virginia. You sound like Jodie Foster.
Jodie Foster.
I look like Jodie Foster, too.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Fuck, I like
can't
Jodie
remember
Foster.
What Jodie Foster looks like.
She looks like me.
Yeah, she looks like David, but with a little bit longer hair. Or not even. She keeps her hair short, right?
Yeah, yeah. She's a lesbian, so... I look like an old, I look like a 59-year-old lesbian.
You know, I just Googled some images. She, you know, I thought you were joking, but she does look like she could be part of your family or something.
She looks like she could be kin.
Yeah.
Kin to the Osbournes.
Yeah, I would love to be related to Jodie Foster.
Your book sales would go through the roof.
That's right. I would put that on every cover. It would be Jodie Foster's cousin, J. David Osborne, and then in parentheses, Jodie Foster's second cousin, twice removed. What does twice removed mean?
They got divorced a couple of times.
Is that really it? I was just asking. I didn't actually think that you guys were gonna know that.
We were set up.
Just ask Kelby and Grant a question about something.
Scientific question. I got a question about genealogy for you. Mm-hmm. Hi everybody, welcome to Agitator. My name is Grant Womack. That is
we're not
Kelby Losek. And today on the show.
And I'm J. David Osborne.
There we go.
I can't take this musical chair shit anymore. I'm not doing it.
My chair is the most musical.
My chair has got bars for days.
Bars for days.
Whatever, dog.
I was listening to the Drought 3 last night. Bro, it's been forever since I listened to that mixtape. That shit is so good. I forget every once in a while. I texted Kelby. I said, I think Danny Brown and Lil Wayne are my favorite rappers. And he was like, yeah, duh. And yeah. But like, I forget. It's the weirdest thing. I forget about Lil Wayne. It's like, you know, when you
I get it.
You know, when you get high and once you're high again, it's like you never left. You're like, oh, right. Yeah, back.
Yeah.
I'm back in the zone. It's like that for me with Lil Wayne. But then when I sober up, AKA stop listening to Lil Wayne, I just completely forget.
You know, that happens to me every time I'll go back and listen to Dedication or one of those mixtapes, and I'll just be blown away and I'll be like, man, Wayne is amazing. You know, but I just think because he's not as prolific. I know he's on a good feature run this year, but he's not like going crazy dropping mixtapes and albums the way he used to.
Had one with Rich the Kid, and I'm completely uninterested in that. I don't know who Rich the Kid is, and I don't care.
Yeah, Rich the Kid's not that. He's prolific, you know.
Every now and then
he has a hot song.
Was that the one where they're like babies on the cover?
Yeah, they're babies on the cover. Sorry, my neighbor's mowing my lawn right now, so I'm trying to mute it when I'm not talking. That's the one.
Yeah, that was good. It was interesting.
Was it?
Yeah, okay. Rich the Kid is kind of but it had Wayne is kind of rapping with that kind of style that, like, I don't know what you would call it, but that like SoundCloud. New SoundCloud, post SoundCloud. Exactly.
Yeah.
You've got Wheezy kind of rapping like that, so it's interesting.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'll check it out. I also noticed that the mixtape was an hour long, and rappers have got to stop doing that shit. These tapes are too fucking long. Give me a 30-minute tape. That's all I need.
I think that's what they're doing these days. It's like 20-minute, 28-minute.
Really?
I just listened to Father's new album, and it's like 28 minutes.
Oh yeah, so. Father too. I always forget about Father.
Yeah, and he's so good.
Young Hot Ebony too. It's a dope album.
Oh, nice. Yeah. That guy loves pussy so much.
He does. He has some crazy lines on this new tape too. I was just like, wow. You know.
I'm out of the fucking loop, man. I was going down memory lane because I was listening to what was I listening to? Mike Jones and then Paul Wall. And then I started listening to Rich Boy, and then Rich Boy reminded me of the song from the Drought, right? Where Wayne raps over, throw some D's. And then I just went down a Lil Wayne rabbit hole on YouTube. And I was just like, I was like, oh yeah. I was listening to like, the Carter Three and No Ceilings. No Ceilings, I think, was big, which isn't, you know, if you ask most people, No Ceilings isn't usually at the top, but it's a personal personal favorite of mine. So yeah, I just fell down a Lil Wayne rabbit hole.
It happens. That's what happens to me maybe like 2 or 3 times a year.
I love watching these old videos too. Like Still Tipping is, I don't know. I love the backyard. Like somebody's barbecuing and you know, it's just, you can see that it's the girls from the neighborhood. So they're like a neighborhood 9, but a real life 5 or 6.
Yeah. That's accurate.
But it just looks like so much fun. You know, it looks like everybody's having such a good time with their cars and the music's great. I genuinely, I'm not just saying this to, you know, because Kelby's here, but I genuinely think that Houston rap is actually the best rap. I think that the screwed up stuff is just the best. It's
pretty dope, that whole Swisha House, you know.
Yeah.
When I sent you Black Gypsies, it slowed and throwed. You know,
you did, yeah. You want to put that in the book, by the way? The slug and throw, that would be funny on the title page.
You know, let's do it. Yeah, fuck it. You know,
let's talk. Oh, by the way, listeners to the Agitator podcast who come here for Japanese movies, today we're talking about World of Kanako 2014. Let me look up the director. This is not a super prolific director. No, not the novel. It's based on a novel by somebody who I just clicked away from, so I don't remember the name. Tetsuya Nakashima is the guy, and apparently he did a movie called Confessions. After this, he did It Comes. I did a dive into his movies also last night, and they all actually do deal with young teen culture in Japan for the most part. His movie Confessions is about a mother who's taking revenge because her daughter gets sold into prostitution and killed. So the themes of the world of Kanako are in this guy's movies. He did one called Kamikaze Girls, which is about the, you know, the baby doll, hyper pop, colorful Japanese chicks. So he's definitely got kind of a theme, but he only did one movie after World of Kanako. And I have a theory that this movie might have ruined his shit, you know, because of how it was kind of universally received. We can get to all that later. I just wanted to kind of throw in that we are actually going to talk about a Japanese movie on this podcast too.
That's a good point. Yeah.
But we have Grant Womack back. What's up, Grant?
And I don't have an echo on my voice this time.
We're on Zoom. I'm just doing Zoom, dude.
The ethereal beings have met up in the clouds for an evenly toned and leveled.
You know, I have a little sage burning too, so it's real, real spiritual.
There we go. Yeah, we're getting real spiritual, but on the same astrological plane this time.
I listened back to that episode. We've done some funny ones. Our episode with Marcus is really funny. And we've done ones that are really good, but I don't know if I've ever laughed as hard listening back to the first Grant appearance. The echoey voice just fucking got me every time, dude. Whenever you would have just a short answer for something, but it would be crazy echoed out. It just, I was crying listening to that episode.
You know, that was a pretty funny episode.
An all-timer. Yeah. That's for the real fans, the day of
OG fans.
It's like episode 11, I think.
Yeah.
And that's my neighbor's mowing. Sorry about that. Can you guys hear that? Can you guys hear the mowing in the background?
No.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I just, my alcoholic neighbor is a really delightful guy. And I mean that sincerely. He mows my lawn and he decided to do it at 8:30 tonight, which makes sense because it's hot as fuck outside. So,
I mean, it does make sense. Yeah.
I'm doing like the last construction job I have on the docket for the foreseeable future. I'm doing tomorrow, like early as I can in the morning, because I'm not trying to still be out there pouring concrete and shit at like noon.
Fuck no. Like, is it? And I'm assuming it's hot as fuck where you are.
Oh, yeah. Hundreds.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we're in the hundreds too. And we've been humid,
we're,
which is
we're
weird.
In the 90s.
Y'all are in yeah. the 90s?
Yeah, I mean,
LA.
Who cares? LA 90s. I mean, it is humid as fuck in LA too, right? I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. It is.
We probably have pretty similar heat because I'm right next to the beach and it's like hot as balls.
Yeah. It's pretty accurate. Yeah. Hot as balls.
All right. Go ahead.
We want to talk a little bit about Black Gypsies, but we want to save that for later.
Yeah, so for listeners of the podcast who come here again for Japanese film, we'll talk about this at the end, but Grant, besides being our friend, is also a very talented writer, and he wrote a book called Black Gypsies that's been in the works for a long time. Grant has revised, and he's also stuck it out through some ups and downs in the Broken River journey. But Black Gypsies is going to come out real soon. It's a really good book, and we're going to talk about that because we have a lot of listeners on this show now. And our main thing, me and Kelby's main thing, and Grant's main thing too, obviously, is writing. So we're going to talk about the movie first, but we are going to talk a little bit about Black Gypsies at the end. We're going to talk about its controversial, offensive title that, you know, makes people not want to work on it and stuff. talk about all that. We'll talk about all that at the end. But I will say that we actually, to be fair, right, because, you know, gypsies is a slur, right? Yeah. We do have a book coming out from a gypsy next year, and it's called Roma Niggas. So it'll all balance out.
Is this a real book?
No.
Oh man, I was gonna.
I was like, where did you find this gypsy rider?
I knew who you might have been referring to, and was like, damn, he went that hard.
I was thinking of a certain rider too, and I was like, I can't see him doing that. You know.
No.
Mm-hmm. Well, Broken River is all about fairness, right? Just equilibrium, and, you know. Making sure that everyone is equally offended, which it is really funny to get. You know how there are some things that are immediately offensive to people, and you kind of get it, right? Like if you call someone a faggot, right, or like a hard R or something like that. Yeah. In America, in our cultural context, you understand that immediately. But then gypsy is one of those ones where it's like, oh, bro, you're digging, you know, like you're trying to find the offense in that word, really. I mean, and it might be different. Like if you're a Brad Pitt in Snatch, you might take offense to that term. But in America, what the fuck are you talking about? Like I would present this. It's like a lot of people don't even know what the word kaffir means, but kaffir in South Africa, it's like their N-word, basically, right? It's like, remember Lethal Weapon 2, where he says, like, he shoots the guy, he goes, like, decaffeinated, right? Like, yeah. That's, it's their version of the N-word, and if you say that shit in South Africa, people will, I don't know, cut your balls off or something, I don't know.
That's it's a pretty crazy line, decaffeinated.
Decaffeinated. But you see what I mean? It would be like if you were like black cat, I don't know, calf or something. And people are like, excuse me. I'm like, you haven't heard that word in 3 years. You have no idea what so you're even
probably
mad about.
Banned in South Africa. Or
banned in South Africa for sure. They'll put a fucking tire around your neck and light you on fire. You'll get that. you'll get necklaced.
Can I tell you about the South African girl I dated in Korea? She'd be pissed. She'd give me an entire lecture about it. She'd be like, you can't do that.
You dated a South African girl in South Korea. Sounds like a song. That sounds like a beautiful song, actually.
Yeah. Maybe I'll rap about it one day or something.
Maybe. You could.
Yeah.
Who's stopping you?
No one. Who's going to stop me?
Who's going to stop me? Who's going to stop me, huh?
I'm just having fun being myself again. Oh, I feel so good. This episode, it's great. I'm David. Hello, everybody. I'm David.
I love how freaked out you got on that last episode.
I got freaked out, but listen. So, Grant, you know the story about Grant Morrison writing The Invisibles, right?
Yeah.
How he put himself into the character of King Mob and a
flesh-eating...
Yeah, right. So in the comic, right, he gets key 23 and he thinks that his face is melting, and then real life Grant Morrison developed a flesh-eating bacteria on his face. So after Kelby and I do the episode, I'm feeling a little weird about it, and that night I'm in bed and I scratch my ear, and I scratch it somehow and my hearing goes out completely in my left ear. It's just gone. Like, my hearing is gone. And so that whole next day, I'm dealing with not being able to hear out of one ear, which is fucking weird. I mean, it throws off your equilibrium. It's a pretty trippy psychedelic thing to completely lose your hearing, but it comes back, whatever. But I'm telling Kelby about it a few days after. I'm like, yeah, dude, I lost my hearing in my left ear. Bro, Kelby can't hear in his left ear.
Wait, hold on. You can't hear in your left ear?
Yeah. He was like, it's real trippy when, like, I don't know if you've ever lost your hearing. I was like, I can't, I'm deaf in my left ear.
Wow, this is crazy. I'm like more impressed with Kelby's audio narration work and rapping abilities now.
Yeah.
Doing it with one ear.
Yeah, only on my right side. Wow. Yeah, that's the blood side, I guess.
I guess so. I'd have to consult the Urban Dictionary about
that. I mean, the left side is Crip side, apparently. But
That's right. Snoop Dogg said that in the song with Pharrell.
Yeah. Drop it like it's hot.
That's how I know that. All right. So the world of Kanako. I was telling these guys off mic, but now I'll tell you, the listener.
Hold on a second. Huh. You know, did your hearing come back?
Oh, it's back. Yeah, it's back.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah, he's not being me anymore.
No. Dude, I swear to God. The episode came, it was out for, we recorded that on a Monday and the episode came out on Thursday. And my hearing came back on Thursday, like once the episode came out.
Okay.
Which is, again, very, very bizarre. Very bizarre shit.
It is bizarre.
And that was like, and the ear was like numb too. I don't know if it was a sinus thing or what, but it felt like I touched it weird and then it went like, and it was just gone. I was like, hello? Hey. And I was like kind of tapping it. Like I had a mic in there. I was like, and the whole ear felt numb. So I have no idea what the fuck happened, but some people don't call 911. I don't go to the doctor. So we thug that shit out and then hope that it comes back, which it did. So you know what made it come back on Thursday? I ate a big bowl of spicy pho, which I truly believe to be medicine, like better medicine than actual medicine. Like if you're fucked up, like if your tummy's bothering you, if you got a headache, if you're hungover, whatever, right? Eat a big bowl of pho with a shitload of sriracha and jalapenos and it just clears you out. So that's,
you know, one of the hardcore listeners is gonna get like COVID and do that, like David told me.
And they're gonna fucking die. And I'm like, oh. I really feel no sympathy for anybody who listens to me. I'm just like, really? you took my advice, you fucking retard.
I did. We weren't on mic, were we? I took your advice. I was like, I found some shrooms in the drawer. I'm gonna take these.
Oh, that's right.
World of Kanako. And you were like, hell yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
No, I did, because here's the thing. I have seen this movie before. I saw it when it came out in 2014 in Oregon with my buddy Eli. What's up, Eli? And I'm a bitch when it comes to pot. I've established that on the show before. I have zero tolerance for it. I don't like it. This is probably one of the 100 times that I've done it, because even if I hate something and I know it's going to fuck me up, it still takes me about 100 times of doing it to not do it anymore. So this is one of those times, and I take 3 baby hits of whatever mutant Portland strain this fucker has, and I'm just high as fuck. And we're in his couch, we're watching World of Pinocchio, completely lost, completely scared, completely disheveled, like no idea what the fuck is happening in this movie because it's so fast and so fucked up. But those were my memories of it. And Kelby hit me up on the text. He's like, hey, I found a gram of shrooms in my stash. He's like, I'm going to take it and watch this. And the angel on my shoulder was like, well, you should warn him about what's going on. But then the devil, AKA the thing that runs this podcast, was like, just let it slide. Just let it go. Just tell him it's a good idea. It'll be fine. It'll be really good. I told Rios that. She's like, that's kind of fucked up. That's kind of mean. And I was like, you know what my response was, really? Like, what? Legitimately? I was just like, he'll be fine.
It's true.
It was your intuition.
It was a hell of an experience, so we'll get into that. What is this movie about?
Right. Should I take that, or should Grant? Do you want to try to describe this movie? I can, but I'm offering.
How do you describe this movie? I guess I could try to do this. So there's this, correct me if I'm wrong. So there's this ex-detective, and he's a bit of a sleazy slime ball alcoholic. And he kind of fucked up his life with his daughter and his wife. He gets this call from his wife, and she's like, where's our daughter? How do you say her name?
Kanako.
Yeah. So he comes over there and goes on this crazy search for his daughter, but he doesn't know his daughter because he's been out of her life forever. And it's just such a fucked up story where we alternate between the past and the present of him going into this drug filled criminal world, and then we kind of fill in the blanks as he's going throughout this narrative. I don't know. I feel like I don't even know how to explain that. Is that accurate?
Well, it switches narrative too with the boy.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah,
it's bouncing around between past of how he fucked up with his wife and daughter, and the present of her being missing and him searching for her. And at the same time, we're getting hints and slivers of what she's been up to through this like actual narration from a high school like victim of hers, in a sense, like this kid who was like bullied, who she befriends and kind of like plays into his sort of infatuation with her, because it turns out Kanako is kind of a Tomie figure, really. Like,
yeah, 100%. Yep.
Yeah.
I'm glad you said that, because very specifically, she sets men off by laughing at them, same as Tomie.
Right. Yeah.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. This is like Tomie noir.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So Grant did a good job at the setup there of what's going on. We got Akikazu Fujishima, who is this, in my opinion, this is one of the just best movie performances I think I've ever seen. Like, I think he's so enigmatic and, I don't know if enigmatic's the right word. He's just a psychopath, right?
Yeah.
But he plays the psychopath so well. I mean, when you compare him with other bad cops, I'm thinking specifically of Harvey Keitel in Bad Lieutenant or Nicolas Cage in Bad Lieutenant 2, because my movie knowledge is just It's limited to very few films.
Films where they're called bad.
Yeah, exactly. He does this so fucking well. He's good. He's in 13 Assassins too, the Miike film that we haven't covered yet. But he's kind of the main guy in 13 Assassins, also playing a very different role. But yeah, so he's called by his wife to try to locate his daughter who's been missing for several days. And he delves into the world. He starts interrogating her classmates. But it also turns out that he is probably one of the most misogynistic characters who's ever been committed to film, which I could not have loved more. This entire movie is just him calling women bitches and slapping them and punching them, raping them, kicking the shit out of them. I mean,
I was just like, wow, you know?
Yeah, I did love it too. Yeah, he can't talk to a woman for like 3 seconds without slapping her and calling her stupid. I mean, I've never seen anything like it in my life. It's a true revelation of filmmaking. I mean, it was just incredible. But like, so he goes into this world, like Kelby was saying, concurrently, there's the story of Seegon, who's this kid who's bullied in school. He gets his ass beat. The violence in this movie is crazy. Even when this kid's getting his ass kicked, it's like highly dynamic and impactful and whatever. And he's got a wall full of pictures of Kanako that he jacks off to, and he thinks that she's great. He is trying to get close to her because her boyfriend Ogata has recently killed himself, and Seegon and Ogata see each other at a water fountain, and they're like, he's washing himself off from getting his ass beat, and Ogata's washing himself off. He doesn't know it at the time, but from getting ass fucked by all these old people, because Kanako basically seduces boys and then gets them drunk at parties, and then, you know, rich, you know, like the head of police, politicians, celebrities, old
Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, it's a Jeffrey Epstein thing where they fuck these kids in the ass, right? So, which does end up happening to Seegon, right? It's pretty rough. It's, I mean, everything in this movie is so fast, which we'll get into, but it's pretty graphic, right? So he gets raped and then beaten up and thrown in the river. And then he kind of goes on. This all happens 3 years before the main plot line, which is what leads to a lot of confusion, right? So it cuts between these two things. And he basically goes on this spree. He cuts this woman's ear off and beats the shit out of her. He hits her with a bat. And then he eventually finds Kanako in this hotel room. And she's, you know, tells him that she loves him and that he can be her boyfriend. And then Matsunaga, this Yakuza guy with a bunch of face piercing, comes up behind him and fucking stabs him in the throat. That's the end of his story, right? In describing this movie, this doesn't happen linearly, right? So like the end of Seegon's story and happens pretty close to the end of the actual film, because we're watching these things happen concurrently. And then to get back to Akikazu, kind of the main story of the thing, he's basically trying to figure out, he thinks that Kanako basically got involved with a bunch of bad guys and that they might know something about where she is. And so he has to deal with this like giggling cop who's always sucking on a lollipop. For as much as he beats up women, he gets the fucking tar beaten out of him constantly in this thing with pipes and bullets and fists, because the Yakuza are looking for Kanako, because Kanako and this Matsunaga guy, who is he's a Yakuza, but he's also a high schooler, I think, or like a dropout or something, like they're in love, and they have decided to take the photos of all these powerful old men having sex with children and blackmail them with them. So the Yakuza are after her. The police are after her because the cops are implicated in this. Everybody's after her. But, you know, spoiler alert, she's been dead for a long time. So that's pretty much it, right? I mean, like that's the plot, basically. I mean, Akikazu, blazes this trail of destruction. He rapes his ex-wife. He finds the cop who's basically doing the dirty work for these old perverts. He's a hitman who really loves killing, but also has a nice idyllic family. So he finds that guy's wife and rapes her. It's fucking like there's no good guys, but I just found this movie so fucking entertaining and nasty and vile, and not even without a moral center, but seemingly completely uninterested in even mentioning morality. You know what I mean? Like it's an afterthought in this.
Yeah, it's, well, if there's any kind of sort of pure center, which there's no morality to ground it in still, because it's just so naive and like youthful from the perspective of what was his name? Saijun? Or the bullied kid?
Seagon.
I mean, he's not a nasty individual, but yeah, no, the movie itself is not coming from any kind of moral standpoint, but I felt at the end of it, as nihilistic and as fucked up as it is, and like, is definitely the bleakest, most fucked up movie I've ever seen, hands down. And I felt very human at the end of it. Like, I didn't feel gross. So I think this film was like, for me, it felt like a successful exercising of like the darkest, most depraved demons.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. Like, I get what you're saying with the bleakness, how dark it is. Definitely one of the most, I was totally unprepared. Like, I've seen a Serbian film and a bunch of other fucked up movies, but I was thinking of the main character similar to like Uncut Gems, how he's just such a slime ball, but it's almost like they crank that shit up another 50% on top of that. And it's just great. Like, it's so, at first I was like, what is David got me watching? You know, which usually I have this effect on other people. So I was thankful to watch this and that I was invited to talk about this, because it's such an amazing experience. Like, I had some vodka last night, and I think I was watching it at midnight, and the pace was just going so crazy. I was like, what is happening and what is going on? And I had to just turn it off last night. Not because it's too fucked up, but so I could retain it. But today I finished it. Just everyone's got to watch it. Like, the pacing too, like, so amazing. And that contrast between the kind of like Seigun, is that his name? None of us know how to say it except David.
Seigun.
He does get presented as such an innocent kid. He just gets so fucked by life. He gets such a bad card. I'm just like, is this kid's whole bloodline cursed? What the hell is going on, you know? And then finally things start to get better, but where the hell was I going with this? But yeah, the contrast between like the crazy violence in the present and then sort of that happy innocence and magic of like high school, I guess, or being youthful, and you still kind of have some sliver of innocence, and then that shit just goes out the window, you know. That was so well done.
Yeah, I want to really quick touch on a point. You said that you had watched a Serbian film, which is interesting. I was listening to the Perfume Nationalist today, and they talk about a Serbian film in that. Shout out, Jack. Shout out, fella. It's a great episode. Everybody should go listen to that. But the thing about a Serbian film is that it is very, from the beginning, it is made to be understood to be about evil, right? About the most depraved, awful. I mean, you know, you got somebody pulling a woman's teeth out and, you know, choking her to death with his dick. And then, you know, the guy basically raping his own son at the end of it. I mean, like, it's so far, as far as movies go, that it's more of a cartoon examination. I mean, it's a great movie, like a cartoon examination of evil. What I think is so startling about the world of Kanako is that it's just not remarked upon. You know what I mean? Like the evil in this movie is just kind of, it's another shot. That's just like, that's just a part of the same. There's like the kawaii girls dancing with like, you know, neon scribbles going on the screen mixed with a, you know, pedophile getting stabbed in the hand, mixed with the Yakuza getting a foot planted inside of his cut open guts, mixed in with, you know, Akikazu raping a woman basically in front of her child, right? He closes the door. He has that much courtesy or whatever. It's literally in this movie, and this is what I think throws people off, right? People can hate or love a Serbian film, but everybody knows what a Serbian film is. And I think what disturbed people about this movie, which I was reading some reviews last night, and people get mad about this movie, which is how you know it's good. What I think makes people mad is that the movie is literally, I've never seen a movie that has just never had a commentary on the bad things that are happening in it like this one before. It's just like, here it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think the biggest representation of evil in this movie too is that lollipop cop.
Yeah.
I thought y'all cut out for a second there.
No, I was thinking about it because I'm like, he definitely is one of the biggest because he's just laughing at everything.
Like
nothing affects them emotionally at all.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know,
it's just this empty, like even like I would say the main detective dude, the fuck's his name again?
Akikazu.
I was just gonna call him Aki.
Aki, yeah. Aki is definitely. I mean, evil. Probably like evil as shit. But I in my life have known like at least one person I would consider truly evil, and they're straight up like that, just like unaffected by anything, and just will laugh at the worst shit going on. So yeah, that guy, once it got to towards the end when they're all getting in the car and they're speeding to catch him on top of the parking garage for that crazy ass showdown, when he's laughing outside the car in that scene before he hops in to go catch him up there, that's when it really hit me. I was like, this dude is the fucking devil.
Yeah,
right. Because it's not that he's unbothered by anything. It's that he thinks that it's all amusing. The one part in this movie that I really cheered at, because a lot of people get hit with cars in this show.
Oh, yeah. Like,
people are always getting hit by cars. This cop gets hit twice by a car. One time he gets rammed. And then the last time we see him, it doesn't kill him, but he gets fucking, sucked up UFO style into space by how fast Akikazu like runs him over. And that was genuinely satisfying. All the violence in this movie actually is pretty satisfying because
it is
because everybody in the, like, there are movies where the noir protagonist gets the dog shit beat out of him and you're like, oh man, fight back. But even when Akikazu is getting beat up, you're kind of like, you're able to just sort of enjoy the violence for what it is, because it's like, well, it's not like good person is getting beat up, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
it's not like a person with an actual soul is getting beaten up, because that's kind of the thing of the movie, right? Is that like Kanako is his daughter and she's a psychopath, he's a psychopath, everybody in this movie pretty much is a psychopath except for that one girl who tases him. I think she's probably okay.
Yeah, she seemed pretty okay. But yeah, the evil, I mean, they do, yeah, it's never that direct. It's kind of like, you know, the old girl at the end of the movie who's trying to dig out Kanako, she calls her evil. I think she may have called Aki evil. One of the Yakuza calls Kanako evil. And I just think about that, like, the genetics of it, energy, like, did she inherit this trait from him? Because he's pretty fucked up. and evil, you know, is this his influence? Was she always like this? Was it just inevitable, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to be saying something about parental responsibility. There was one, I can't remember which interaction it was, but there was one interaction between characters where, and it might have been Aki and his wife, where she kind of threw it on him and like the whole situation that they're in. And I was like, damn, I mean, if this movie is saying anything, which if it is, you just have to take it subconsciously because it flies so fast and it doesn't linger on shit. But I don't know. And as a parent, I was just thinking, like, you know, like, this is obviously some major parental neglect going on among all the kids in this movie.
All of them, yeah.
Yeah, so a couple of things. First of all, since we've mentioned it so many times, I'm going to actually throw this in here. I went back to the movie and I found a minute of it at random, and I counted the shots in this movie. And in 1 minute, there were 41 shots. Which means if that pace is kept up, which it kind of is, that means that over the course of a 118-minute movie, there are 4,890 shots in the movie. Now, for perspective, I looked up online the fastest cut movies. Number one is Doomsday, and that was 4,502 shots over 105 minutes. Transporter 3 has 3,360 shots over 96 minutes. I did some quick math though on all of this, and The World of Kanako actually has the number one movie beat by like 3 or 4 percentage points. So as far as I know, as far as I could find on the internet, this is the fastest cut movie maybe in existence. I mean, I'm sure there are experimental ones where they do it really fast and it's all split. But like in terms of a major pop release, this was distributed by Alamo Drafthouse. I think this might be one of the fastest movies that's ever been made. And it feels so fucking long, right? Because of how fast everything is cut, he starts figuring shit out and all the pieces start coming together about an hour into the movie, right? I remember I paused it at an hour and 6 minutes and I was like, oh damn, this thing's wrapping up. Nah, dog, you got another hour in this movie. And I remember thinking to myself when I did that, I was like, where the fuck are they going to go for an hour? Like, there's another hour of this shit.
You know, I mean, I was excited. I did wonder where it was going to go to. I was like, so much has happened already. You know, it's got to end soon.
Yeah. But that ending in the snow is so beautiful and so tragic, but at this, and it is heartbreaking because you do get a little bit of like compassion, like you're allowed some compassion because you do feel for the chick who lost her daughter due to Kanako. Or no, her daughter was a daughter. She didn't lose the daughter, but Kanako
pimped her out.
Yeah,
that's right. Kanako pimped her out, and yeah, she was none too pleased with her.
She was none too pleased. That's right.
She became a murderer that day.
yeah, she did, which a lot of parents I think could definitely relate to, you know.
Well, I would straight up murk the fuck out of any
Kanako.
If a kid came to me and was like, guess what I got, you know, so and so into, I'd be like, no. Like I would just shoot them in the head, and then I would eat the charge and be like, okay, yeah, no, it had to be done. So yeah, basically, as I said at the beginning of the description, Kanako has been dead because a few days before Akikazu even begins his search, she goes to one of her teachers whose daughter is one of her classmates. And because Kanako is this sociopath, like the actress who did this, I think fucking killed it, right? Because the ability to be like, the word is kawaii, right? It's this Japanese word for cute, but it's a very Japanese thing with like the baby doll dresses and giggling and, you know, just acting super cute. Like her ability to like balance that, it never comes off as campy or over the top. But like watching her, you're like, that is exactly what a sociopath would be like, yeah. Right? Just somebody who's empty. So she takes her teacher and they're sitting in the teacher's van and she shows her pictures of her daughter getting fucked by old dudes. And this lady just straight up, after crying for a little bit, fucking stabs her with a screwdriver and kills her and then buries her in an undisclosed location. And the movie ends with the longest shots in the movie that are still not very long, but when you've been sitting for an hour and 50 minutes with this rapid fire pace, the fact that the ending 10 minutes is paced like a, basically like a normal movie, it feels very reflective. And you know, you feel like you're out there in the snow because Akikazu finds her, he figures it out. He figures out that she killed Kanako and he decides that her penance for this whole thing is going to be that she's going to locate the body that she buried in like 3 feet of snow, it's the dead of winter, and dig her up because it's Kanako's birthday, right? Because Kanako would be 18 on that day. And of course she can't find him, and the movie kind of ends with you know, she tries to escape a few times and he beats the shit out of her, she beats the shit out of him with a shovel, but he's like, as we've seen throughout the movie, a guy who's been beaten with a lead pipe and shot. He's kind of he's this, you know, we've all met people like this, right? Who are just kind of tanks. Like they're not buff, they're not tough, but they can just take a beating. Like that's this guy, right? Like that's you. Yeah.
I was like, he's so me.
And
then so he was Kelby. Like, bitch. I was like, damn, this guy is like,
when he's raping that woman in front of her son, Kelby's like, yeah, that's me. But
I mean, he was called everyone bitches left and right.
That's the only thing he calls women is bitch. Like when he goes to Matsunaga's mom's place, which is this fly infested disgusting tenement apartment, and she's this, you know, kind of pie face fat bitch who lives in filth. Oh, yeah. He just starts beating the fuck out of her. It's like, take care of your fucking kid.
Yeah, I was like, whoa. They would say, how are you? You know, like, yeah. I'm going to fuck you up. Yeah.
That's what it was, actually. The irony of that scene, when he comes in and he just immediately is like scolding her, like, you, the fuck is wrong with you? Take care of your kid and everything. It's like, bro, really?
And yeah, that's, look at yourself.
That's when it kind of hit me. I was like, you know, if anything, this movie has a lot to say about, you know, it's kind of like when people will, I'm not into like shit that really bums me out, like real life shit, like Investigation ID and stuff like that. But when shit happens to kids on the news and then people start fantasizing, like if that was my kid, I'd get that motherfucker and I'd tie him up by his toes and this and that. Like this movie feels kind of cathartic and like throw in the most evil shit you could think of in a box and just not having it go well for pretty much anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I like that. I like this idea of the revenge film, because there are revenge movies like Old Boy where at the end, you know, this guy has hypnotized him and made him fuck his own daughter. And then there's I Saw the Devil, which I think is maybe one of the best revenge movies ever, because the protagonist is chasing down this serial killer who killed his wife, but he doesn't want to put the bullet in the guy's brain. He just wants to torture him. So he keeps like beating the shit out of him and letting him go. And every time he lets the guy go, the guy does something progressively more fucked up, right? So by the end of it, everything sucks, right? Like this serial killer has essentially ruined the cop's life because he wanted to draw out his revenge to the point that it ended up consuming his entire life. All these movies, you know, make these really interesting points about like what revenge is, but I think that the world of Kanako might be better than those movies because of its emptiness, right? because of the just complete sociopathy on display. Does that make sense? I don't know if that made sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's like a revenge film for the viewer, not for anybody in the movie.
Oh, that's a fucking great way of putting it. Thank you. Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, it's actually doing the revenge film by, like, you get to see everybody get revenged on, right?
Yeah.
Like you're not in the protagonist's body being this weapon of vengeance. You're just seeing everybody get shit on, but everybody deserves to be shit on. So it's kind of nice. It's, except for poor little Seagun, he gets stabbed in the throat. But back to that scene at the end, right, where he's forcing this woman to search in the snow. That's when it all kind of clicked for me, right? Because this movie's definitely about it's about parenthood, essentially. It's a fucked up way of looking at parenthood, but
yeah,
it's very much about how kids kind of take off on their own. I'm thinking specifically about the scene where Seon goes home after being raped and decides to go on his own revenge spree, and his mother's trying to stop him, and he beats the shit out of his mom, and he's got a little cartoon bunny on his jeans, which I thought was like a really nice touch of just this, you know, this little sliver of childhood on this this kid who's been so violated in such an adult kind of way, you know. But there's nothing that the mom can do. Like, he pulls a box cutter on her and is essentially going to kill her if she doesn't let him go out and take his revenge, right? So there's, at a certain point with a child, there's nothing you can do. Secondly, though, and most obviously, it's about how parents don't involve themselves in their kids' lives at all, right? Because every parent in this is a deadbeat. Every parent doesn't know what's going on with their kids. Every kid can't relate to them. Kanako's last speech as she's bleeding out in the van is explicitly about how the woman who just killed her doesn't understand her own daughter, who Kanako has been pimping out, right? She's like, you don't get it. You don't know her. You don't know what she likes. Like, she liked doing this. And you wouldn't know that about her because you don't know her. And I think that the ending of the movie in the snow, how long it takes, how tedious it is, I think that this whole movie really works as a metaphor for raising children. Because what do people always say when you have kids? Like, cherish it when they're little because it goes by fast.
Yeah.
It goes by fast. So what does this movie do? The whole movie goes by so fast. Even though it's long, it goes by really, really fast. And when you get to that end scene, when Kanako's gone, Kanako's dead, she's buried under snow. She's gone off on her own. Akikazu has squandered his relationship with his wife and his daughter. He's only able to achieve a facsimile of an actual familial relationship by literally beating and raping his wife and screaming at her to make him breakfast in the morning, right? Like, he's completely fucked it up. But then once they're gone, time slows back down. You see what I mean? Like, time slows back down, but they're already gone. And it ends with him saying, like, I'll find her and I'll kill her. I'm going to find her and I'm going to kill her, which is that whole thing, right? Like, I brought you into this world, I'll take you out of it. Yeah. What this movie is saying is, like, no, what you do, everything goes by really fast. And if you fuck it up, you get to spend the rest of your life digging in the snow for your kid's corpse, metaphorically speaking.
Yeah. It's a great point.
Yeah, that's some deep shit. Yeah. And by the effect it had on my shroomed mind, because it's such a strobe effect.
Like, yeah.
It's such a strobe light paced movie that, like, the first of all the it elicits this vibe of, like, upper anxiety mixed with euphoria, kind of like being on ecstasy and speed at the same time, which is something that I used to do a whole lot. I, like, had that same exact feeling come rushing back to me, especially when they, like, with all the party scenes and stuff, I was like, oh my God, like, my heart was jumping on my tongue. And it's this weird, like, detached sort of dream state where the violence occurs, and like it's visceral and it's satisfying, like you said, in a way of like seeing this like crazy violence and not really giving a fuck who it's inflicted upon because they're all shitty. But like at the same time, it has some sort of level of detachment to it. Like if you're dreaming and your dream is extremely violent, but you feel kind of outside of yourself, so it's not like you're all the way there. It's just like blood is splattering on the wall and you're just like, oh, look at that. That's crazy. That's kind of how this movie feels too in those scenes. And that like the Alice in Wonderland symbolism too, whenever she like, she's always reading from Alice in Wonderland and she talks about falling down the hole, and or she describes it as a tale where this girl Alice finds a rabbit hole and decides to climb into it, and then she just keeps falling. And that's like the vibe of the whole movie until you come crashing into that end scene where I was just like, by that time my heart's racing and I wanted it to keep up the pace, because when it slowed down I got freaked the fuck out. I was like, can this please be over?
It does go on, right? I mean, the ending, it does that thing that you see so rarely in American movies where it has a coda. Movies in America don't have a coda, they end. But I see it more often actually in Korean films than Japanese films, but there's always this third part to the movie after you think the movie is over where they're like, nope, now we're going to investigate the consequences of what happened in the climax. But no, I feel you. I wasn't high and I still, I was like, is this, how much more movie do we have left? Like,
yeah.
I refuse to check the time in moments like that, because I feel like it kind of breaks the spell if I know that there's like 2 minutes left. But I don't know. I was really kind of caught up at the end in the brilliance of the whole thing. And it was like all the parts were kind of clicking together for me. And I was sort of able to realize what a great movie I was actually watching at that end, which is, it's kind of cool from a storytelling point of view. You know, we're all writers here. It is kind of cool actually to give readers a bit, because, you know, as writers, right, when you get to that climax, when you get to the end, you're trying to fucking end the book, right? You're trying to go out with a bang. But the idea of a book or a movie going on for an extra, you know, 30 pages or 15 minutes, it's kind of compelling to me. Because now you have to think, you don't get to just shut the book or turn the movie off and go about your life. Now you have to think about it with the movie or with the book.
Yeah, I mean, I was sober today watching it, and my heart was racing. I had major anxiety throughout the movie, but in a good way. It was definitely thrilling. And then at the first, I think I said this off air, the first 10 minutes, or maybe I thought this, but the first 10 minutes, I was just kind of like, I don't know if I like this or not. I was like, this is moving so quickly and so fast, but then you just sort of adjust to it. I feel like someone kidnapped me and threw me in a van and they're going 120 miles per hour, but it's so great. And like you said, towards the end, once it slows down, I was like so impressed by all the storytelling elements, even that Alice, like none of the elements are just sort of thrown in there. Everything's carefully thought over and interwoven into the narrative. Like it's so essential. But yeah, by the end, I was just sort of floored that we had to go through this, you know, third act. And I did just kind of have to lay there in bed for a good 20 minutes and think about this movie and let it absorb, let it percolate, let it marinate, you know?
Yeah, it did make me think from a storytelling perspective too, that it would be fun to, because you couldn't make how I typically do with like having sort of ideas and some notes and then just writing the main thing like in, you know, 4 or 5 days. You couldn't make this shit up as you go. Like all the pieces are there, and this is like very scrambled up and mixed around the way that it's delivered. Like you have to know everything that's going on in this movie. If you're the one making it, like you have to know everything that's going on first and then rearrange all the pieces in this like chaotic, scrambled manner, which would be a really fun way to actually, I think the thing that you and I, Grant, are one of the things that we're working on, I think would be interesting to sort of put in that scrambled, jumbled narrative.
No, that is a good idea. Yeah, because I was trying to think about the storytelling in this movie and how can I apply it to my fiction or like future work, because it's so well done, and I'm like, wow, maybe I could have extended this story or that story to kind of show that. But that is a good idea. I did think, like, I don't know, I assume both of you have probably read Clive Barker complete, you know, but Books of Blood, I think I had a similar feeling reading some of these short stories back in the day, way back in the day, where there was a few times where I would think it's about to end or it's going to end, or like the Midnight Meat Train, completely different, but he never shies away from showing you like the end and then some, and then the consequences. You get what I'm saying? Or is that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it's like, not many people do that.
I didn't read the Midnight Meat Train, but I saw the movie. That's an excellent film. That movie is so fucking good. But yeah, I think that when you're telling a story, I don't know. I feel like everybody's been psyoped by this three-act structure. And this idea that we're supposed to have a rising action to a climax, and then you know, maybe like a 5 or 6 minute denouement where people fucking, you know, they're having like the best movie that had a commentary on this was Pineapple Express. You remember at the end of Pineapple Express, they're at a diner, and they're fucking like they're literally just recapping the movie. They're like, remember the part where you did, you know, that was a great commentary on the whole movie structure that we're all so used to, where this kind of stuff happens, and then, you know, at the end, everybody you know, we flash forward 3 months, and you know, everybody's wounds have healed and they're meeting up, and they're like, what are you gonna do? And the hero puts on sunglasses and says, I'm gonna go on the next mission, right? But what happens in those 3 months, right? I mean, what does actually go on? What's the point of telling a story if you're gonna leave out all the interesting stuff that happens after the bad guy's dead? And I think that especially Korean movies, but Japanese movies to a certain extent as well, are really good about investigating that question. They basically say, you know, the story's not over. We're not done just because the bad is dead.
Yeah. Well, Japanese, they kind of seem like they revel in that, berating you, like, you know, now what did we learn?
Yeah.
You did the bad thing. Did you learn anything from?
Yeah. That is how it feels. You know, be a better parent. Take care of your kids. Talk to them. Engage with them. You know.
That's what, every time we get canceled on this show, one of our Japanese listeners emails in and is like, what did we learn?
The answer is, every single time, the answer is nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all.
You just keep doing the same thing. If Kelby and I have learned anything from doing this, it's that we say things and then people get upset and then we ignore them, and our audience just gets bigger. So there's really, there's, in terms of risk reward, there's really no, I don't know. It's just kind of makes sense to do that. But so overall, I mean, this movie's got, if you're a gore fan, I think it's some of the best gore I've ever seen in a movie, the most realistic. It might be a factor of how fast the movie is paced, but the blood spurts every time Akikazu gets hit, by the way, it's really funny. There will be this, you know, flash card on the screen of like blood, black blood splattering against a red background, which I think it's really funny that he chose this Seijun Suzuki, Quentin Tarantino pastiche mode for the movie, because it doesn't fit at all. It truly does not fit the tone of the movie, because it is not a slick, cool, fast talking, dialogue heavy. Like nobody in this movie looks cool, is what I'm trying to say, right? Except for him, kind of at the end when he's covered in blood in that white suit, that does look legitimately tight.
He kind of does dress cool too, like you.
Yeah,
would expect, he dresses
cool. Yeah, you know. He dresses cool. Yeah, he's got cool sunglasses. He's always smoking cigs. But like, I think that the people at Draft House who distributed this movie, I think that they might be retarded, and they might have been taken in by the whole Quentin Tarantino thing. But I think that's a big joke, right? Because I think that this guy chose to appropriate this kind of grindhouse style. But he's like, but no, but I'm going to do it for real. You know what I mean? So it's like this kind of, you know, graphic, at times cartoonish, bloody violence. Because, you know, by the way, how about that ending scene with the hitman cop on the top floor of that parking garage, right? I mean,
fucking, when they show
the
top,
fucking scene.
Yeah. When we get that top down angle, because it's obviously, you know, they're bleeding, there's blood spattering, they're shooting each other, they're punching each other. Like, he shoots his wife like 3 times. He's like, could you forgive me? And she spits in his face.
She just got raped, and she didn't know that he was like involved in all this dirty shit. And this is, by the way, this is a character who we have spent zero time with, but as is the case with a lot of Japanese movies, which I appreciate, they have this amazing ability to make a character who just popped up feel like the whole movie's been about them, right? Like, all these characters who've been in just a completely different movie just show up, right? And it's this family man, his son is in the back seat, his wife is duct taped, you know, titties looking all weird from being tied up, just got raped by our hero, actually. And he pulls the duct tape off her mouth and says, like, about all this, can you forgive me? And she spits in his face. And so he just shoots her. But it's not like a clean movie shooting. He shoots her once and it doesn't quite take. So then he shoots her again. And he shoots her again. And you just kind of see that with his son in the back seat, right? And as is the sort of mode of this movie, completely unremarked upon. We're on to the next thing, like 3 seconds later.
Oh god, when the son is like in the cops and everything, they just drive away and then the son is left there, and you know nothing good is gonna happen for the rest of his life.
I was like fuck, I wanted to just hold my son.
I know, dude, but you see how this movie, and this is a point that you and I have made a lot on the show, Kelby, is that you see how effectively this movie makes points by aggressively attempting to not make them. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's aggressively forcing you to just like think about something for a second, and then we're onto, you know, Matsunaga in a body bag with a Yakuza dipping his fucking snakeskin boot into his intestines. You know what I mean? It's so adamant about not lingering on any kind of moral decision that it gets under you. This might be like This movie might be a top fiver for me, actually, after this rewatch.
It's definitely like one of my favorite movies this year, like top, because I was already trying to think like what's the top movies I've watched this year, but it's definitely going up there in like maybe top 10, top 20 at least. It would have to be another conversation, but I get what you're saying with the it makes these great points without forcing it down our throats. It's kind of like this weird negative space that you kind of have to take a step back and see or sort of ruminate on. So
yeah, you're 100% allowed to like all the complaining that, you know, I've done before about movies until I, you know, decided that I'm not watching anything ever again that I think looks like dog shit. But my big complaint with movies, like, is shoving everything down your throat. It's like, I'm not retarded. Like, stop beating me over the head with this. This is like the complete opposite of that. It's not going to tell you what to think about anything. It's not even going to allow you time for it. It's just like, all right, on to the next scene. On to the next 30,000 frames per second.
Yeah, and that I think is where most of the bad reviews came from, because people are babies. Just as a side note, it's not relevant to, but I was looking up Goodreads reviews for Coin Locker Babies, which is our next episode. There's a lot of one, all of Murakami's books have like 3 stars on Goodreads, because it's either people who are, you know, giving him a 5 or giving him a 1. And everybody who gives him a 1 is like, this is disgusting. It's gross. It's not, you know, it's like, oh, you're a little baby.
Yep.
you need someone to hold your hand and tell you what's good and bad. And I don't think I've ever seen a movie that so adamantly refuses to tell you what to think at all.
And I think that's why, like, I didn't even feel bad at the end of this movie. I felt very alive because I was completely allowed to explore my own feelings the whole time. I was never being told what to think or who to root for or who to root against. It was all just presented, and it was invigorating, and it was disgusting. And at the end of it, I had all my own thoughts with no interference. And I was just like, I feel like a person from watching, like, probably how some, like, you know, no shade, but like some basic Southern Baptist type, you know, standard moviegoers who just like everything. It's like Armageddon, that was a great movie. Titanic, great movie. You know, it's all just that type of person might feel at the end of watching like Facing the Giants or some shit. Like, that's how I felt at the end of this movie. I was like, wow, I feel like a person.
I get what you're saying. I mean, I think David said human.
Do you mean remember person. The Titans?
Yeah, maybe.
You know, Facing, I was confused. Giants. I was like, what is Facing the Giants? This is a big movie I never saw. But I'm not saying anything.
Oh, he said Facing. I'm sorry, Grant. You were making a good point. Please continue.
I don't remember, but you made a great point there. It was all good. But yeah, it was invigorating at the end. It was disgusting. It was like thrilling. I felt like it was this amazing roller coaster. It did make me feel alive, where it's kind of like I made this big intention at the beginning of the year to kind of like consume a lot more art that moves me and makes me feel something. So this movie definitely fulfills that, ticks that box and fulfills that intention and that goal for me, because it's kind of like I felt everything and then some watching this movie, you know? So
hell yeah.
Yeah.
Good shit.
Okay. All right. End movie talk. That's the end of that. Hope you all enjoyed that. Now we are coming to the part of the, you know, I, Agitator is a show that normally runs about an hour. We've been doing this for like an hour and a half. But I'm really inspired by Jack doing a 5-hour Silent Hill 2 episode. So we don't have to go for 5 hours, but I also don't feel bad about it being an hour and a half and we're still going.
Okay, so, I was just looking for my mustard can when you said that to to piss on Mike, but
there's one thing that I want to do, which is I'm going to stop recording for just a minute because I had to switch my internet connect. Okay, tell me if this is crazy. So I was using a VPN and the connection was getting bad. That was when our voices were clipping and shit. So I switched over to my regular internet. We're still on Zoom. So this is still recording to Zoom.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, so changing from the VPN to my regular connection isn't going to fuck up the episode, right? Because no. I've been thinking about it this whole episode, like that I'm going to get something that's all fucked up.
Yeah, that little red light is still blinking at me. It's still watching me.
Yeah, nobody got kicked off. Everybody's still here. No, so that means it's still recording.
So what we found out is your VPN don't work.
The VPN, the VPN, government. Dude, the whole VPN thing, I think it's all fucking fake. Like, I have it. I paid for it for 2 years, so I have the VPN, and that's cool. No, they can never find you for any... Whatever, dude. Fucking whatever. It does keep movie companies from sending me letters in the mail, which I have gotten before without a VPN for downloading movies. So that's good, I guess. But something. I don't know. What do you guys want to talk? You guys want to talk about Black Gypsies?
Yeah, I want to talk about Black Gypsies. But, you know, speaking of VPNs and the government, you know, last night I woke up at like 4 a.m. hearing this crazy sound. And, you know, I watch too much conspiracy theory shit. So I heard this weird high-pitched frequency. And I immediately thought to those people, you know, like whistleblowers who talk about like they're being stalked.
Gang stalking.
Gang stalked. And they're sending these microwave frequencies to fuck with your brain. Because it was kind of giving me a headache. And I was like, you're being fucking crazy, Grant. You're not exposing anybody or anything, you know? But I was like, what if I accidentally did, you know? Because, you know, in my last newsletter, I was talking about Jeffrey Epstein's billionaire mentor who's dead with a Jewish demon, you know?
Wait, hold on, yeah, back up. Little, what? Which newsletter was this? So I read your newsletter.
This was the one before. Kelby, did you read that one?
Yeah, yeah.
So Whitney Webb. I'm pretty sure you know who Whitney Webb is.
Oh, right? I love Whitney Webb. She's great.
So she posted, she's writing a book. And she put an excerpt of her book out and she was exploring Jeffrey Epstein's mentor. Forget his name. But they did like a New York Times like profile on him. And he was talking about the, I forgot, I don't know how to pronounce it. The Dibiuk or whatever. Dibbit. The Jewish demon. And he was like, I ride around in a car with it. It encourages me to buy up properties and it just feeds my greed. And he openly talks about this shit in the entire article.
Let's go. Alex Jones. Yo, no, all this shit is true. All this shit is true, though. It's fucking real. I mean, so I feel like people can get wrapped up in this kind of shit. And I think Whitney Webb is great. She's cute, too. You ever seen her? You ever seen a picture of her?
You know, I thought she looked kind of plain, but maybe I could see theoretically her being cute. I could see
if Grant's she got a bit, guess, they have to have like fake asses and lip gloss for Grant to be interested. If they just look like a normal woman, Grant's like, I'm not seeing it. I don't know. What is it?
I'm sure if she could get spruced up, you know, she might be a little,
hey, Whitney Webb,
a little sexy.
Whitney Webb, get spruced up, you dumpy bitch.
They're gonna be like, Grant hopped on there and they started objectifying women. you know.
So. No, she looks good, man. She looks good, and she's really smart. And
she is really smart. Good. I love her articles. You know.
Yeah, she's good with all this conspiracy stuff too. And I think that you can get, I think you can get too lost in the weeds with a lot of this stuff. But yeah. I think it is good to have a baseline understanding that these people are actively being skin ridden by ancient demons. I think that's just a good baseline thing to understand. And I'm being dead serious about that. Like everybody,
I agree with you.
Whether it's fucking Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or Jeffrey Epstein or you know, Barack Obama, whoever, right? Like all skin ridden by demons. And I think like the world starts to make a lot more sense. The trick is you don't start thinking that, well, I'm gonna change the world. I'll just load up this 45. You know, like I'm gonna fix all. You don't fix it. You don't fix it.
No, yeah. It's just part of exist. It's just part of struggling through this incarnation. Is knowing that there's that here there be demons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. That's 100% it. So I definitely do like that. But sometimes I'll you know, a new article from what's the Mint Press, right? The website that she is on all the time.
Oh yeah, they'll
like drop a new article and it'll be all about digging into the origins of COVID or this. It's stuff that ostensibly I'm interested in, but I'm like, man, I'm not gonna read all that. TLDR, yeah. Like, I don't know.
No, that's me too. I'll try to bookmark some shit. I'm like, I'll take your word for this.
Yeah, like if you tell me COVID's fake, I'm like, I've been there. I've already think COVID's fake, so I don't need any convincing that COVID's fake.
Same.
You just want to give me some bullet points, I'm good with that. But like, and if you've ever listened to these, because I've listened to Unlimited Hangout, her podcast, with some people, and it's always, you know, it's all about the web of connections of people. And I get so bored. It's just names, right? And they'll be like, and so Jack Smith, he actually golfed with Howard Hughes. And those people are important. And I'm like, bro, I don't, just tell
no,
me.
No, that's why I felt with one of those so Whitney Webb episodes. I was like, this is intriguing, but it's kind of like, yeah, the babysitter and the golfer, the caddy, they're all connected, and my mind's supposed to be blown. That's cool, but you know,
I just get bored, bro. And it's like, that's why Alex Jones goes so hard, because he's just like, you know, they're literal vampire demons who want to suck your blood. They want your kids to be trans vegans, and you know, all this kind of shit, right? And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm good with that. Like, I'm the Alex Jones tip. I'm, you know.
Yeah, where he runs outside of Bohemian Grove and he's like, all your presidents and all your politicians are dancing around naked in the woods as we speak.
Dude, Alex Jones is the truth. 100. Like, I will never back down from Alex Jones' defense, because he has, because I feel like he's like me, you know? I mean, he's kind of retarded, but he also kind of gets it. I've always felt like that was me, right? Like I'm kind of retarded, but I also kind of see things, you know what I mean? And I might not be as studious as Whitney Webb or as articulate as some other folks, but I really identify with just this big barrel of like this, you know, just an alcoholic human being who's just like, everybody's a fucking demon. I feel like I really relate to that.
Yeah.
I think you're not giving yourself enough credit. But I agree
with you on that.
Because you're
about what?
About being articulate.
Yeah, I think you're a lot more articulate than you realize, even on these podcasts and in your writing, and you know.
Oh well, thank you. The only real smart people are the people who you never hear from, are people who are inventing anti-gravity technology. It could not be fucked to tweet about a TikTok video. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
None of us are smart because
Twitter, we're all every day.
We're all on Twitter, so none of us are smart. Like,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, even Neil deGrasse Tyson, he's
not smart, bro. He's not smart.
Like, he just wants to ruin everyone's fun every day.
Yeah, he can catch these hands.
Yeah.
Dude, 100%. I'm glad you said that. 100%. I would fuck up Neil deGrasse Tyson.
I would start beef with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
I would hate crime the fuck out of Neil deGrasse Tyson. Yeah.
Hell yeah, dude. I'd be right there cheering you on. I would be texting you on Signal. Like, that's a great idea, Kelby. You should do that.
Did you see when B.O.B. and him had a little rap beef?
I do remember that. B.O.B. is another actual, you know, he's I have a lot of respect for him because he is retarded in the Alex Jones sense.
Yeah.
Right. So the book opens up in a barbershop. This is the much discussed barbershop scene that you and I have gone back on. There's been a lot of work that's gone into getting this tattoo shop.
Yeah.
God, again, racist. He just assumed.
You know, I actually have another book with a barbershop scene opening. You know,
I love that. I love that as soon as you get accused of racism, right? As soon as you get accused of racism, there will be a black person there who will be like, I mean, that's kind of true, though. I mean,
yeah,
I was going to do that. No, it's at a tattoo shop, and an old head is talking to a young jack boy car thief. Well, he's not a car thief. He steals parts off of a car, right? They'll take their tires and their rims and shit like that. There's a shooting that occurs while he's getting a tattoo. This is the stark opening of the book to kind of put you in this world of the South Side of Chicago and these young black men who are engaged in a kind of dog eat dog feral existence, right? So we have our hero. He encounters some enemies on his walk home. I think that this scene is particularly well done because it's not overly, you know, the bad guys don't come out and say like, what are you doing walking around here? Yes. They say, you know, they're like, hey, come smoke with us. And, you know, and our hero is like, okay, cool. And every threatening situation I've ever been in with people who are kind of like this has played out like that. I often say that Mexicans are really good at this, right? Like if a Mexican who's, well, I should say a cholo, right? Like a cholo type person, if you don't know them and they get way too overly familiar with you, that means you're in danger, right? That means that there is trouble because strangers should always be standoffish. And if they start to kind of pretend to be your friend, you might be in for something. So the book goes on from there. I think that it does a really good job of touching on without lingering on kind of aspects of this life. Our hero, his friend Gordo, is particularly obsessed with his clothes, but he's a big fat fuck. And, you know, there's a lot of humorous shit with that. They go to some parties. Our hero meets a girl who he starts to fall in lust with. In the middle of the book, in the middle of the book, there is a inexplicable and completely amazing hardcore sex scene that it, as far as scenes go in the book, it's the longest one. And I think both myself and Kelby encouraged Grant to not cut it, but to in fact make it longer and more explicit. So there's a lot of, you know, choking on dick and, you know, it's these two characters, but the whole book stops for a whole chapter so that we can get a play-by-play of them fucking each other, which I thought was really cool. I thought that was super
so great. Cool. I had no notes there. I was just like, yeah.
It's like she pulled his dick out of her mouth and, you know, there's like vomit, like a string
like
of
stringy, vomitous, drooly, you know, porn quality head going on.
And he like throws her up against the wall, like it's no kind of gentle, like, you know, I've done not nearly as much editing as Dave, but I've done like some editing on the side, or, you know, beta read for people, which I call sigma reading. I've done some sigma reading for people, and, you know, doing the like audiobook narration and shit.
people do sex scenes, and it's almost like they all went to the same school of virgins who are just like trying to imagine what sex is, and they're being all delicate and using weird terminology for cocks and pussies. And reading your straight up pornographic, horny, aggressive, like play by play was so refreshing.
Oh, dude, Grant like, fucks, man. Grant fucks.
Yeah.
You know my least favorite euphemism for a pussy is when they say, you know, he slid his member into her sex. Calling a pussy like a little sex is like the most, ironically, the most sexless thing you could possibly call a pussy. Like, I've never once looked at a pussy and been like, ah, her glistening sex. But people use that shit all the time, and I'm like, they bro, do. Just call it a pussy. Like, everybody, pussy makes me feel warm. You know, like the word makes me feel like I'm curled up in front of a nice fire. It immediately calls to mind a nice pussy, because you never think of a bad pussy when you hear the word pussy, right? Like, if somebody's like, you know, she took off her panties and you saw her pussy, like, you're never like imagining some
like roast beef looking ass.
Nah, you don't think about that shit.
That's funny. So I feel like the sex scene, the book is well written, and I think that it's very effective in what it chooses to do, which essentially boils down to you know, money stolen from the wrong people type scenario, right? Yeah. Like, these our characters steal some money from people who it shouldn't have been stolen from, and shit goes down the way it goes down. No spoilers on this show.
Yeah, but no spoilers.
I keep coming back to that sex scene because I think that something that Kelby and I talk a lot on this show about is tonal shifts in narratives and how interesting they can be. And I think that Black Gypsies is really good at providing a kind of pace and tone of a narrative, right? And then in the middle, completely jarring that with this sex scene. And I hope that people who read it really get that out of this book, right? In addition to being, you know, there are more niggas in this book than in Kelby's by a country mile. I counted them, and I said how many, Grant, I texted you.
You said over 100.
There are over 100. Yeah. Yeah. And this is a very black book. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is all black
characters.
This is a 30,000
left
book.
And right.
Yeah. Like, oh, you can tell it was written. I have a theory that most of these people with fake African names on the New York Times bestseller list, that they're all middle-aged white women, and and they're all libtards, right? And so they've got this in their brain that, like, if they type the word nigga, that they're gonna like go to hell or something. And so, or that the whole facade is going to break and everybody's going to find out that they're white and it's going to be not okay for them to say it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you never see it in the books. And I'm like, this is not a black book. There's not a single N-word in here.
Yeah.
There's no way. Do you know what black people say more than anything? The fucking N-word. Like,
The time, dude, all the time, because it's an amazing word. And, you know, it's one of the best words in the English language, and black people should use it as much as they want to, and so should white people. What? Why is that funny?
But Black Gypsies, very black book. Chicago.
I'm very excited.
You know,
very excited.
Very inspired by Chicago. You know, for a long time, I was sitting here waiting. I was like, all this crazy gang violence is happening in Chicago. Like, we don't just have Bloods and Crips. We have like GDs and BDs, which is like Gangster Disciples, Black Disciples, Latin Kings. And a lot of people don't know about them, but it's kind of like,
oh, I thought you made that shit up. I thought you made the Gangster Disciples up.
That's real. Like Lil Durk, Chief Keef, all them. They're all like BD, GD. Okay. Yeah, like that King Von getting shot, all that's over like that type of gang shit, you know, like Lil Durk's dad
is like a high ranking, I can't remember if he's a BD or a GD. I think he's a BD, but he's like very prominent figure in that gang too, you know? So a lot of this inspired it. And, you know, you go across a lot, you come across a lot of people who will kind of like, if you wear the wrong colors, like even if you wear black socks, hat, and black and white, you know, they may come to you and be like, what's up? You know, what do you rep?
Ooh, it's too easy to aim for a target sitting on a fence.
Yeah, yeah. So for a while, I was kind of like, when are the crime writers going to write about like GDs and BDs? And they call them BDKs, GDKs, you know, gangster disciple killer, black disciple killer, all that shit, Chief Keef, all them. But I never saw anyone write one of these books, you know, and like you said, you didn't know until today that these were real gangs, but they are, you know?
Yeah, no. And that's why I think, and that's kind of been the whole mission of Broken River since its inception, is to find writers like you or David Simmons, right? Who's got a book coming out around the same time as you, who are doing interesting shit that isn't getting the attention from the mainstream. So I think it fits in very nicely. I think we've got a very nice Matthew Rivera cover for this one. I think that it's a book that I'm proud of, that you should be proud of, and that people, I don't know, man, I have a good feeling. I feel like people are going to read your book. I feel like,
I think so too.
I feel like Broken River had to go through this weird hiatus period or whatever, like soul searching kind of thing. And then, you know, I wrote some books, linked up with Kelby, started doing a podcast, you know, a lot of the No Country podcast that I do with Chris has helped. And I feel like it's ready to come back, because I feel like Broken River has always, I don't know, there's like an unspoken thing about the press, right? Where it's just a vibe. Like you're going to get something different. And
yeah, there's a lot of respect for it. I feel like every time I post about something, even like I'm kind of sort of on Facebook again, people get excited and they're always like, Broken River's back, you know?
Yeah.
Oh shit. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. It's like, oh, I thought that guy just became a Nazi and disappeared.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you're only half right.
No, but it's been great merging the podcast with the, like, you know, since the beginning, it's been like, you know, we're writers and we're friends and we started this because we talk on the phone all the time and might as well record the shit and center it around some kind of art that we're fixated on. But like the, where the fuck was I going? Oh yeah. So in doing that, and people realize, like, coming to our art from being fans of the show, building a fan base where people actually fuck with your shit and not just being stuck in a writer circle of like people telling you to mind your manners, or we're not going to publish you for the 12 other people to buy it in the circle. Yeah. Like, people read all over the place. Like,
that's right.
Every time I see somebody like, well, people don't read anymore, I'm like, you should slap yourself in the face. Like,
really should.
People never stopped reading. Y'all just don't know how to write cool shit and put it out there for people. The thing is, they don't really care about readers. Like, it's bars. It's staying bars within that circle.
Yeah, no, that is so fucking true, dude. And I think that Broken River started off as my attempt to just do something really cool. So, you know, I came out the gate, I had a Stephen Graham Jones book, Jed Ayers, William Boyle, you know, two of those authors have gone on to have massive success. And I attribute that to them being just really good authors who people like to read. And I put out a bunch of books. Every single book I put out, I'm proud of. I think that I've built a kind of a reputation for doing cool shit. That's right. That's right. Yeah. We reworked Zero Saints. We reworked Zero Saints. Yeah, we reworked that book to make it, you know, to make it pop, right? But I think that it was necessary to kind of, like, especially with the kind of cultural moment that we had, that I think was really deadening to a lot of people's artistic impulses. I think that I basically 100% credit a few things. The first is actually Kelby, my friendship with Kelby. I think really Kelby's ability to not give a fuck and to just be chill about shit and also be really good at what he does. I find that inspiring every day, same. Every time that we talk. And then the Pervume Nationalist, which is a podcast that has said some wild shit, most of it true, but Jack's ability to, you know, champion an artistic and aesthetic impulse and kind of a pleasure seeking motive over everything else has, like, every time I listen to that podcast, I just, and listen to him and his guests talk, I get, you know, inspired to say, you know, fuck everybody, like, this is what I do. Those two things I really needed in my life to be able to surmount this cliquish hole that I found myself in, where everybody's just like, you know, oh, don't do this and don't do like, I don't care.
That's true. I mean, I had to go through a similar thing over the last few years. Even Kelby helped me too, because I'll text you, Kelby, and I'm like, is this too much? Was that sex scene too much? Are they going to call me misogynistic, you know, because of Twitter? But then you kind of get that fuck it attitude where it's kind of like, what does it matter? Like, I'm trying to make art. I'm not trying to please my next door neighbor or Joe Blow or James Patterson, you know? So, but yeah, I mean, it's a journey. Twitter especially is kind of like just a circle jerk. Policing, especially in the writing community. I saw people get so angry about the James Patterson thing. I said Cry Me a River, but these people wrote like entire book threads on it, like yelling. And I'm like, okay, I don't ever want to get that worked up about something like that, you know?
Yeah, if you have an opinion about James Patterson, you are gay.
Yeah. Yeah, with a capital F.
You are gay with a capital F. Well, fellas, that's a 2-hour episode. And I kind of feel like this might be the best one yet. I'm really excited about this episode. So any parting thoughts before we go?
I think people should watch Road of Kanako, smoke more weed. You know, so Twitter doesn't get them all riled up. And buy Black Gypsies, buy God's Leftovers this August.
You know? Oh yeah, God's Leftovers too, which I also read and worked on. Did I work on that one, or did you just send it?
You did actually. I think that may be the one project I paid you to help do some edits. There's been a couple more like revisions, but yeah.
David, and you also seen almost you also paid all. Me. You paid me $5,000 to be on Broken River too, so there's that.
No, I'm $5,000 vanity crasher. That's false, actually. You know,
that is a not true statement. But yeah, no, I did. Yeah, I remember. The only reason why I asked is because in the past 7 years, I think I might have worked on 300 books in that time, maybe 350. Yeah. It's an insane number of books, and I'm still doing insane. It. I'm working on a book right now. It's just what I do. I pick up a book. I see the same problems. I should write a book about the things that I see in editing and then
help
people to read it. Cause I'm like, oh, there that thing is again. They're doing that thing.
That becomes your best selling book. You know,
probably.
I just see so much. I don't know. I see really good books that just need a little bit of tweaking. I see really bad books. I mean, it's everything in between. But yes, buy Black Gypsies, buy God's Leftovers. Pay attention to Broken River, because I haven't said this on the show yet, but tentatively, no, you know what? Definitively, we're back.
We're back, baby. We're back. We're back. There's a lot of good shit cooking behind the scenes. Rapper eater.
Feed me, feed me, feed me. No homo. Yeah. One time for me, one time for the DJ. He be Cali, I be Louise. Baby, if you ask me, if you're nasty, creative, gifted bastard, spit sporadic. I'm so diplomatic, democratic. Touch it, bring it, push it, systematic. Damn right, I kiss my daddy. I think they pissed at how rich my daddy is. And I'm his kid, I stunt with my daddy. Call Miss Lee, she with my daddy. So diss me and gon' diss my daddy. Cause who was that when no one wasn't just my daddy? Who was that when I needed money? Just my daddy. So who be that when I see the money? Just my daddy. Who said that I'll be the one? Just my daddy. Hello, hip-hop, I'm home, it's your daddy. When I say these, I don't mean the caddy. I mean these nuts, acorns and Cali. Rick Ross tip, stunning fat joke. And I can't forget Briscoe. Yeah, I just watched the bullshit with so. It's a bakery here, just trying to get dough. Shout to my dreads, my H's and cheek codes. You're looking for me, ho, I'm in the 305. I'm the best rapper alive. Homeboy got a mind that a mat wouldn't find. Homeboy got a nine that a cop wouldn't find. But I did get to it even if I was blind. Like a scary movie, they screaming when I rhyme. I'm a king, you could ask Steven if I'm lying. I'm a prince too demanding like my mom. Too bold, too cold like West Salam. Me, it's all about me. If the girl got a voice, did she tell about me? Me, he say, she say, I say me will be in the M-I-A. Me with me and T and Big Ronnie in the homie streets. Probably somewhere on the beach. And Taz and E, probably somewhere in the Jeep. And Marlon in the Phantom with Mr. G. And me, me, it's all about me. Play with me and it's all out beef. Beef, yes, chest, feet, tag, bag, blood, sheets. Yikes, yeeks, great, Scott, Storch, can I borrow your yacht? Watch me and my clique go all out. Like the ball in the stands, we balls out. Boy, I don't know what y'all about, but I just spit like a dog mouth. Pink ice just looking like a hog mouth. Vroom, I had to bring the hog out. Yeah, like them trees, bring a log out. Every day Christmas, I'm eggnogged out. And hip-hop is my new bought house. My flow just grew legs and walked out. Bye.